And you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 100.5 FM.
Ethiopia came to the world's attention in the beginning of the 1980s when a series of famines hit the nation. 30 years later, Ethiopia boasts one of the strongest economies in Africa. But activists are concerned about the methods of this economic progress and its impact on fair access to land. Anuradha Mittal is the founder and executive director of the Oakland Institute, an independent policy think tank based in California. She is also co-author of a joint study with the Housing and Land Rights Network about the disturbing human rights situation in Ethiopia. They submitted their report to the United Nations in September, and Anuradha joins me now by phone. Good morning, Anuradha. It's really great to talk to you again.
Good morning. It's wonderful to be back on the show again.
What role does land play in the lives of regular Ethiopians?
Well, in terms of land and the areas that we're looking at, for instance, in Gambela, or you're looking at Lower Omo, the southern part of the country, these are the communities who are predominantly indigenous communities, ethnic tribes that depend on land for their livelihoods, for their very way of life. For instance, in Lower Omo, most of the communities are pastoralists, and they have their cattle, and they need those corridors that they can move from place to place and graze. To some people and listeners, it might seem like, wow, that sounds like a weird way of life. It seems like a waste of life, of resources. But you have studies from United Nations to academia which clearly reflect that given the harsh natural conditions in that area, that is, pastoralist way of life is the best way of livelihoods and the most sustainable way of livelihoods. So land is relevant not just for livelihoods of people and for their way of life, but really also for sustainability.
And how is land ownership governed in Ethiopia?
You know, it's a very interesting question. In case of Ethiopia, because of the kind of history the place has had, all land supposedly belongs to the government. Having said that, the constitution and the government is supposed to recognize the customary rights, the rights of people who have been living on the land forever. What I'm trying to say is it's not as simple as the land belongs to the government, so the government decides tomorrow to do A, B, C, and then suddenly can uproot everyone and move them away. It does not have the right to do so.
And are people protected then against evictions?
Well, supposedly, people are supposed to be protected from evictions. More important, Ethiopia as a country is signatory to various international human rights covenants and conventions, which do protection to people. However, the reality on the ground today is very, very different.
Tell us about the Growth and Transformation Plan and Villagization Action Plan.
Sure. So, you know, when you look at the media, or if you happen to go to USAID website or the DFID, which is the aid agency from the United Kingdom, if you look at their rhetoric, Ethiopia comes across as a renaissance state. Ethiopia comes across as one of the strong economies that is growing in Africa that needs to be supported, is a key ally of the West, whether it is a war on terrorism, the support for its overall development policies. That development scheme, which has been so celebrated, is really based on intense industrialization of agriculture. And for that, what is really happening is that the lands that the communities have used, whether it is the Anuaks in Gambela, whether it is the Suris or the Mursis or the other communities that live in Lower Omo and in other parts of the country, such as Afar, those lands are being seized. And they are being made available to foreign investors and also to domestic investors, by the way. So the idea is that, say, in Lower Omo, where nearly 500,000 people depend on the floods and the water of River Omo to grow their foods for the cattle pastures, those very fertile lands, those people are being moved away forcibly. And they are being leased out to Indian sugar companies, to the Chinese, Malaysian, and to the domestic investors. And all of these schemes are being justified through a scheme called villagization. So the rhetoric of the government is that through villagization, we are creating these villages by which better social services will be provided, such as education, such as water. But our fieldwork over the last 3-4 years, innumerable trips to the area by different researchers that we've put out in different reports, clearly show that people are not being compensated. There is no free prior informed consent. In fact, there is no discussion and dialogue. People are being threatened. People are being intimidated, being arrested. There are reports of rapes and killings, and they're being forced out. And the plan of the government is to relocate forcibly 1.5 million people by the end of this year.
So it sounds like there's a radically different experience on the ground than what the rhetoric is of voluntary resettlement and these benefits of creating villages then.
Yeah, well, it'll be important for the listeners to know that it is not just one lone group, the Oakland Institute, which is making these allegations. When we first came out with these reports in 2011, which were based on, as I said, months and months of very intense field work, speaking to the communities, where researchers were arrested, where people are intimidated, and yet they spoke and would not give their names because they're so afraid of the Ethiopian Defense Forces arresting them or harassing them the next day. Since then, whether it is the aid agencies such as USAID or DFID, they have done their own investigations, and they very well know, because this year we released transcripts. We released also the recordings of what they were told by the communities who are living under such serious oppression. And yet we find the world look the other way, and the Ethiopian government carry out this villagization, this forced relocations, so they can advance themselves economically. So the larger common good is advancing, so a handful of people can benefit, while the indigenous, the pastoralists, the most marginalized are being oppressed.
Sounds like a terrible situation. I want to turn to the role of humanitarian assistance, because Ethiopia remains one of the top recipients of humanitarian assistance. What happens to those donations when they get there? How are they managed?
Well, you know, one of the reports that we have put out this year clearly shows that on one hand, while we're celebrating Ethiopia as a Renaissance state, nearly 60% of its budget, national budget, is made possible through aid, whether it's from the State Department, whether it's from the USAID, World Bank, and then DFID, as I said before, the aid agency of the United Kingdom. In case of UK, Ethiopia has been the largest recipient of UK non-humanitarian aid with growing allocations. So they have been providing support to a program called Protection of Basic Services. Now, when you hear Protection of Basic Services, which focuses on education, water, agricultural extension, health, you know, it sounds really good, and it feels like aid monies should be used for that. However, the problem is that it is an unconditional support, and it actually provides, it functions as a budget support for the existing federal and local government expenditures. And because of that, there are actually a lawsuit in the United Kingdom against DFID by the communities who have been abused, who have been oppressed in Gambela, saying that your support of these programs of the Ethiopian government is actually facilitating this villagization, which is basically a nice word, a nice name for these forced relocations.
Now, I understand that the Ethiopian government has a new plan to deal with some of these and other human rights violations in their nations. What's your assessment of that?
With growing pressure, and definitely the Ethiopian government is feeling it, as you know, the reports that we have put out, the findings have been echoed by groups such as Human Rights Watch, that pressure is increasing. So far, the government has been very defiant in terms of justifying and claiming that its programs are meant to benefit people. They accuse groups like the Oakland Institute of being neoliberal fanatics. So they are calling out names. But the fact is that more and more testimonies are coming out from those regions. You have to also understand that Ethiopia is a country where there is no independent media. There is one state-owned television, state-owned newspaper. Most of the journalists are either in exile or behind bars. In fact, just yesterday, a new report was launched by the Human Rights Watch, which shows that members of opposition, members of journalism are actually being abused and tortured in Ethiopian jails. So there is no free space to be able to discuss, to debate, or to question government policies. At the same time, NGOs that work on governance issues and human rights have been banned from operating in the country. So given all that, our work is really focused on international aid agencies, and that's what we are focusing on. And if you look at the last report, Human Rights Report and the State Department report on Ethiopia, I mean, the report sounds no different from our report. It acknowledges this whole environment of oppression and no space for journalists to speak out or to voice their concerns or for civil society. But at the end, they choose to justify it by saying, oh, well, the country has a deficit of democracy. So groups such as the Oakland Institute are continuing to put pressure and, more important, to educate our congressional members as well as senators and, more important, taxpayers, that how our tax money is used to provide aid for programs in Ethiopia which are leading to creating more food insecurity, dispossession, and the worst kind of oppression of human rights abuses.
Anurad, it sounds like an absolutely terrible situation with very egregious human rights things. What do you see as the critical factors that could influence this to make some kind of change for the Ethiopian people?
Well, I think, the most important thing is to realize that Ethiopia is the closest ally of the West in Africa. And if it is our friend, friends do not allow friends to do such bad things. So given that the country, 60% of the budget is dependent on three agencies, World Bank, United States, and UK, we know what we have to do. We have to become good friends, which we need to put pressure on the Ethiopian government, that its oppressive tactics, its intimidation, its rapes and killings need to stop, that the development policies, which are based on abuse of human rights, are not development policies, and that genuine development can only occur when all strata of society can gain and benefit, when we see real respect for human rights, and that's what we're pushing for, because those are the leverage points. It is very hard for our partners from Ethiopia to organize within the country. I really want to emphasize that we could not have this conversation on a radio station in Ethiopia. A, because such radio stations are not allowed to operate. Two, if we tried to do that, we would be arrested right away.
Well, it's been good talking to you, Anurad. It is a very distressing situation, and we'll try and stay abreast of it. And I really appreciate your joining me this morning.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Anurad Mittal. She's the executive director of the Oakland Institute, and she's the co-author of the Human Rights Report on Ethiopia, recently submitted to the United Nations. And you can get more information or read their full report at oaklandinstitute.org.